Hello and welcome to Kitchen Curiosity. I'm your host, Radford Chancellor. On today's episode, I'm joined by two esteemed guests. We're going to be talking about their careers, what's up and coming in the market. We're also going to be talking about what good kitchen design looks like and technology in the food service equipment sector. This episode has been kindly sponsored by HCE Food Service Equipment. My first guest is a well-known international food and beverage consultant, a chef by trade, a former judge on BBC MasterChef, has a career spanning over 40 years, with experience in 2- and 3-star Michelin restaurants. He's been described as the founding father of modern British cuisine in Manchester. He's consulted all over the world, in countries such as Spain, Greece, Germany, Saudi Arabia, Italy, France, Channel Islands. This gentleman was consultant chef to Manchester City Football Club and the City Football Group. He's been elected Master Chef of Great Britain for over 30 years and has won many awards, including Hotel of the Year, Restaurant of the Year, Culinary Gold Medal and Chef of the Year. He's well known for his straight-talking, no-messing-around, hands-on, practical approach. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome to this show a titan of the culinary world, one of the best food and beverage consultants money can buy, Mr. John Benson Smith. So, John, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thank you, Radford. Good.
good. So, John, just to kick us off, and thank you for joining me on this first podcast. So, I don't know if it's a rumour or what, but I've heard that you were the original flavour designer for Walker's Food Sensation Crisps. Is that right?
Yes. It is, yes.
Well, how did that come around?
I got invited by Walker's, together with a number of other chefs, probably about half a dozen of us, to talk to them about flavour designing. And we went off to the Swan at Streatley to do like an audition, mm-hmm. Where they gave us a blank bag of crisps with no marketing or anything on it. And we were told to go off to a hotel bedroom and write up a short, punchy presentation on what we thought about the crisps and the market, etc., and then come back and present to about 50 to 100 people.
Wow.
And the other chefs were all very nice and polite and lovely, and I thought, I've got this really wrong. So I kind of just went up there and said, guys, you know, I love you all, but is this the best we can all do? Hellfire, you know, type of thing. And they, half the room stood up and clapped, and half the room kind of looked at me in horror. But yeah, I got taken on as the original flavour designer.
And that was...
which was fascinating. And then...
was that all the flavours or what? Because I remember when they launched that, was that... yeah, so was that every single flavour you put together?
Well, I actually designed 60 flavours.
Wow.
And then from the 60, we worked it down to 30, and from 30 down to 12, and then I think we finally went in with 10, I think, which was... it was... and then that took about a year, actually a very long year, a year with a bit on, before I one day walked into Booth Supermarket in Windermere and turned around, because I'd been looking month after month after month at the crisp aisle, as you do because you're sad.
Yeah.
And I then...
waiting for it to come out.
Spied, isn't gonna be there. Spied the crisps, and then I ran to the cash out and said to the girl, I designed these. And she kind of said, 3-2-1, 3-2-1, can we have... and then a security man arrived, thinking I was obviously, you know, fruitcake. But no, that's... yeah, it's a story. It's good.
Wow. No, that's pretty impressive, I have to say. So I know you, John, and I think it's fair to say that at one point you wanted to be a footballer. I think that's a fair comment. But kind of in a funny kind of way, you definitely elevated yourself in the football arena. But... what made you become a chef? What was the inspiration, really?
Well, I was completely useless at school. I was pretty good at art, but I was rather mixed up. I wasn't really interested in anything. But I was interested in football, David Bowie and Barry Sheen, or a bit before Barry Sheen, you see. So I decided when I went to my careers lesson, they said, what do you want to be, you know, a train driver or whatever? And I said, no, I want to be... motorcycle racing champion, I want to be a pop singer or a professional footballer. So anyhow, my parents had a rather large house back in the day, and my mother used to do a lot of entertaining. So I used to get dragged in to peel the potatoes and chop things up and all the rest of it. So that's how that started. And I began a very tough, difficult, old-fashioned apprenticeship. Mm. You know, where I think I'd worked 5 days a week and went to college 1 day a week in Hull. And I think out of a couple of years, I went 3 times to college.
Wow.
But who cares? It was good. It was good.
Okay, so it was really trade-based.
Oh, yes, it was repertoire de la cuisine. It was Pelle Prat. It was French. It was all of the French style cooking and dishes. And, you used to learn about all the garnishes and Parmentier and Bordelaise and Bonfam and Colbert. You know, it was great. There was a basis to everything.
Yeah.
You know, there was a framework to it. There was a structure to your learning. Mm. Couldn't speak any bloody French, but it was good.
But yeah, you could cook. So, I mean, you've gone on, you've worked in some amazing places, haven't you, really, all over the place. And you've worked in France as well, I'm correct in saying, a few places.
Yeah, I did. Well, I continued as an apprentice and then became a first commis and a commis chef and all the rest of it. And then went to work in one particular place where there was a very, I would say, new wave English chef who was very loud, and he'd been trained by John Tovey and Robert Carrier.
Right, okay.
He didn't speak French. He wasn't interested in France. It was all about English and produce locally and being English. And he kind of said to me, listen, bleep, 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 if you want to get on, you need to sort your head out. Otherwise, you might as well go and work in the supermarket. So he gave me a bit of a kicking and said, you know, if you're not careful, you're going to be successful. So from that moment onwards, I then decided to hell with it. I'm going to get out there. And I did a lot of stupid things in my life. But one thing I did, which was really good, was have a very, very structured career of 18 months when I was learning, or 3 years in each different establishment. And then when I became a head chef or a more senior, 5 years.
Right.
So you could see kind of a very clear structure to my career.
Progression and structure.
Yeah.
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 What cuisines and, you know, ingredients kind of inspiring you at the moment in, you know, as we see in the market?
There's so much, but most of my work, some of my work is menus and dishes, but a lot of it is forensics of investigating a business that is possibly needs to, you know, improve, mm-hmm. or one that's down the dumps. So I do a lot of forensical investigation of businesses to try and understand where they're at, where they could be, and how you bridge that gap.
Right.
But that's a 360. It isn't just let's look at the food. It's also looking at personnel and design and layouts and logistics, ergonomics. It's the whole business from kind of P&L onwards. So it's very varied. I mean, I was talking to a hotel yesterday. It could be a restaurant. It could be food production, theme parks, bigs, and the dreaded football. I shouldn't say that.
Yeah, but
after working at 18 football clubs, Radford, I love them all to bits, but wow. You know, that was a long period of time.
Yeah, I mean, you're known as obviously the, you know, the absolute master in stadium catering and other projects as well. So yeah,
that's definitely.
I mean, I remember once when I was a chef by trade, you know, and coming to work to find out that all my mise en place had been destroyed because the walk-in fridge had gone down the night before. And it was before the time of, you know, all these systems that are connected to the internet and they send you a text message.
Yes.
So, can you remember sort of a similar disaster? Have you faced those sort of disasters in with clients or yourself? Or?
Or someone decides to use the floor cleaner and unplugs the freezer and those kind of things. But I think one that really sticks out was, I suppose, going back a long time when gourmet gastronomic dinners were the in thing. Mm. The Imperial Hotel at Torquay, when when it was a five-star hotel that used to have these gastronomic dinners where they invited 6 or 7 or 8 chefs from all over the world to come along. And they invited me. And I remember that the chef that chose the dessert, who I didn't particularly like, you know what chefs are like, I mean, they're, you know, it's like a lot of different dogs in cages barking at each other.
Yeah.
And he was doing a baked Alaska, the baked Alaska, but this was for 900.
Wow.
So you really need to sort your life out with
a big,
900 individuals with, it was with what I used to call punk rock haircut, which was spikes of meringue, which you used to like pipe on them and the next one and pipe it on and then icing sugar. And then he decided that he was going to use a ginormous blowtorch. I am talking something that was 5 foot tall than a trolley.
Wow.
And it looked like something out of a war game. And he lined up 100 on a table and lit this thing and fired it at it.
Oh, my God.
And I'm thinking, hell's bells, I would have rehearsed this. Anyhow, he blew 70 off the table that all smashed on the floor because this thing was so powerful. And of course, anyhow, we've all been through those things.
yeah, so he was 70 down. Boy, did they have ice cream in the end or something?
Fruit salad or maybe cheese.
Yeah. So, I was looking, obviously, you know, you've kind of made it, I think you made it in your career when you've got a scholarship after your name. I mean, and you've got a scholarship from a well-known college in Scotland. I mean, how did that come around? How did that happen?
They approached me, probably because the work I have done with learning and education hasn't just been about how to cook the fillet of brill or turbot or how, you know, to do saffron potatoes. Yep. It is that, but it's more about survival in the big world and how to, you know, achieve and move forward and become commercial. And because of that, they really like that kind of approach. In fact, I think there were two scholarships named after me.
Right, okay.
And I had to quickly think, hellfire, I'm an Englishman in Scotland. Okay, yeah, right. Yeah. My great-grandfather was Scottish. You know one of those stories, Radford?
Yeah.
Don't tell anybody.
But
it was good. It was good.
Did you get a chance to go up there much or just...
I was up there last week and 2 weeks before,
right, okay.
Actually.
Quite a lot.
In a castle. Because I do a lot, again, of this in kind of looking at businesses and looking at how one can improve it, which sounds very glamorous, but it's not, and it's tough and it's difficult. And, you know, you if you go up there on the pretense of looking to help improve someone's business, you've got to deliver. You've got to come out with the solutions that are really going to work.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, great, John. Well, thank you for that about the scholarship. And what would you give to new chefs coming into the market? What bit of advice could you give to someone either thinking about joining the trade or just joining and leaving college?
Well, I was shocking at college and I was terrible at school and I left with no qualifications whatsoever. If I drop down dead tomorrow, which I don't want that to happen, but I can kind of live with what I've done and what I've achieved. I think throw yourself at it. And if you're not careful, you may very well succeed. You can travel the world. Food will take you everywhere if you're clever. And if you're clever, you can also earn a fortune. But be careful how you spend it, you know. And the two important things are health and happiness.
True, absolutely true. And I mean, you know, chefs, you're never going to be out of work, are you? Let's be honest. Always going to be someone wanting to employ.
No,
well, hopefully not. Anyhow.
Yeah, and you know, I firmly believe that. You know, and it can be a marvelous life. But yes, there's the other side of it, which I talk very openly to the guys. The college, which was about debt and drink and drugs and, you know, having a tough time in your head and that kind of stuff. But I think, you know, it can be an amazing, amazing industry. I could tell stories until the cows come home. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah.
How has the culinary landscape changed for you from when you first started? In the UK specifically, I'm talking about.
Well, from 1975 onwards, a lot. Yeah, it's very, very different indeed. Some of it's not, because you're still dealing with potatoes and broccoli and all the rest of it. But yeah, it has a fair bit. And the cooking styles and, you know, in those days, it was all about a knowledge bank. Imagine yourself as a as a can of petrol or a, you know, the petrol tank in a car. You spent years and years and years taking on board knowledge, 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 which you couldn't get off Google. You couldn't get it off an iPhone. You couldn't get it off anything. Mm-hmm. You had to physically go and learn it. Because in those days, there was about three books.
True, yeah.
Anton Mozin and Aru Brothers one.
Now,
and
now I think you was, can go that, and watch that was YouTube it. So if you did TikTok about it and, you know.
Oh, you can. Yeah. So that's a tough question. It's changed dramatically, but I'm able to mix it with the, I suppose, the ancient and the modern.
Right. Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Bringing in old cuisines and then sort of modern twists them in.
Yeah, but also I'm able to run around a kitchen with 18-year-olds, you know, in Oman or Saudi Arabia or wherever, or people older than myself. It doesn't really matter, really, you know.
I mean, when I talk about Saudi Arabia, you know, I know you've worked a lot. You've done quite a bit of work in Saudi. And I saw just recently, I think it was January, they've licensed the first establishment or venue or something for alcohol after 70 years of prohibition.
Yeah, and I did 6 years of working in Kuwait,
right?
You know, as consultant, but hands-on, tough stuff. And I really enjoyed the food out there. In fact, I was there last year for 6 months as you know, working as a managing director of a merging of two huge big businesses in Kuwait, right. Which was working with distributors and suppliers and M&E and all the architects and the grumping and, you know, all the rest of it. Right. It's fantastic, really. Amazing. But Saudi and Kuwait to me is very, very clean, very, very safe.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you come back to the UK and I'm kind of, whoa, lock my car doors compared to over there, which was
amazing. Fantastic.
And the quality of the fit outs and the equipment and the architraves and the doors and every single bit regards kitchens. And it's don't say to me, please, well, I got loads of money. Mm. Rubbish. They just do the job properly generally. So doing new openings and concepts out there is amazing and memorable. And my English is pretty good now as well.
Yeah, and it's becoming a great tourist destination. They're really pushing tourism, aren't they? So a stunning place to visit, I think.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I absolutely love Cadbury's chocolate. I mean, I've got to say that that's one of my biggest vices in this world. I need to stop eating it because I'm putting weight on. What's your kind of guilty food? What's your go-to guilty food pleasure?
Well, it's either Rolos, Maltesers, or bacon sandwiches.
But that isn't altogether. Yeah.
No, it's not. No. Probably Maltesers at the end of the day.
Maltesers, yeah.
I love those old-fashioned kids' sweets. They're amazing. Or you find them in your pockets and they've been there 5 years. You still eat them, don't you? Just make sure there's no fluff on them.
Yeah. I actually saw your comment the other day about the rolling sweet trolley thing you used to do in Man City and going around offering old-fashioned sweets to the guests, which is quite good, quite cool.
Well, the point I was trying to get over was sometimes you can do amazing things without any money. And nowadays, everything seems to require huge financial investment. Back in the day, you know, when that particular football club, which is very, very close to my heart, 20 years with them, you know, God help them. But, you know, in those days, we did a lot with nothing. Whereas nowadays, they're, you know, great business, but it's very different now. We used to make do with nothing, and it made you become very, very creative.
Well, I think now as well, it's all kind of, and I see it as well, it's got it Instagrammable. You know, if you can get it Instagrammable, then you can make it successful, even though the offer might actually be rubbish. So, John, my final question to you, and it's something I'm going to ask all my chef guests. You're hosting a dinner party for three people. Mm. Which three famous people, dead or alive, would you invite? What's the menu going to be and why?
Well, I'm going to be naughty with this one and slightly bend the rules because I can.
No, absolutely.
I'm by far the oldest and cheekiest guest you're going to have. Right, David Bowie. Mm-hmm. Okay, David Bowie. We're going to have Barry Sheen. Right. We're going to have Lawrence of Arabia. But Lawrence has brought Omar Sharif with him.
Okay,
so there'll be four of us for dinner. And right. we're going to have fish and chips. And the reason why we're having fish and chips is because when Neil Armstrong, who was the first man on the moon, visited the UK once, he came to Hazelwood Castle and he didn't know what fish and chips was, so we gave him fish and chips. So,
and did he enjoy
there
it?
You are. I don't know. I think so. I hope so. I hope so.
All right,
yeah,
okay.
He did. I wasn't sure if he had salt and vinegar or pickle onion or curry sauce or something, but yeah, it's good.
Yeah, yeah, I just wonder how Lawrence Arabia is going to handle fish and chips. Are you going to serve that with mushy peas or bread and butter? Or what's the score there?
I think big, massive slices of bread and butter that's cut.
Are you actually going to cook it, John, or are you just going to buy it from... Are you just going to cook it, or are you actually going to buy it from the local fish and chip shop?
I'm going to sit there with him, and we're going to go to, you know, a fish and chip shop and sit there with all the tiles and the great big kind of fryer and the pickle onions and stuff, you know what I mean? Definitely.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
And we're going to have a can of Tizer or Shandy or the other stuff, dandelion and burdock.
Okay. I mean... That's great. It wasn't the answer I was expecting, and yeah, it's definitely a naughty reply. But yeah, that's really good. We're going to take a short break now before me and John are joined by our next guest to talk about what good kitchen design looks like and discussing technology in the food service sector. HCE Food Service Equipment was established in 1985. HCE has grown to become one of the UK's leading suppliers of commercial kitchens and catering equipment. They offer a complete comprehensive service, including design, sales of equipment, project management, installation, after-sales service, and planned maintenance. Now, my next guest joined our industry at the age of 17 as a trainee service engineer. He's worked his way up through the industry in procurement, project design, procurement manager, and then sales director. He's now a director at HCE. He's won many accolades during his career, including Cedar Large Company Award, the PIMCS Award, Cedar Cost Sector Award. And his product portfolio is nothing short of outstanding, includes projects such as Ascot, the Savoy Hotel, Corinthia, Bacardi Ford Motor Group, Wimbledon, Virgin Money, and that's just to name a few. It's my pleasure to welcome to the show a gentleman of our sector, Mr. Steve Holly. Steve, what makes HCE stand out against your competitors in the industry?
I think mainly because we're a humble family-owned business. We're about 30 people. We've had steady growth over the years. I think that we've got very robust processes in place which enable us to be consistent in what we do. Truth to tell, if I go back a few years when our managing director, John Greep, took reins of HCE, one of the biggest things, he came from a construction background, M&E in fact. One of the biggest things that John identified was that period between securing an order and delivering the kitchen. Invariably, companies employed salesmen who would make the sale and they'd see the sale through and they were project managing. Most of our competitors were doing it as we were at the time. John saw different to that. John saw that we need M&E background people. So we developed the role of project manager, dedicated project managers. And I think without going into too much detail and boring you, Radford, that I think was the most significant thing because dedicated project managers can focus on delivering the project. They're hands-on. They're on site when they need to be. But the best one in the world, a salesman, salesperson, they want to get onto their next order and they want to earn their commission, bonuses, etc. So I think that made a big, big difference to our growth. And we still maintain that policy today. We've got a number of project managers. So, yeah, that's what I think really gives us that. People come back for more if they enjoy the experience.
Yeah, and I mean, I can vouch for that. I've had firsthand experience of your project managers and project management style and a very big multi-million pound contract in London, and Colin Smith, your project manager, was looking after that one. And I've got to say, I mean, I genuinely got to say, was an absolute pleasure to work with him. You know, attention to detail and focus in every project meeting. Well, yeah, it was a joy. So yeah, I totally get what you're saying.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah.
I mean, how do you ensure sort of quality and durability of the equipment that you distribute? Because obviously I know you deal with like a myriad of different manufacturers. And I guess you get approached by new people in the market all the time. I don't know, but how do you ensure sort of quality and durability?
Experience, for the most part, knowing what products are right for the job and what applications. I mean, as you rightly say, there are so many different variances and types of operation. I think from my point of view, it's being able to deliver the customer's expectations on time, on budget, and ensuring it's a successful project all around. To do that, we had to ensure that we were in control of our own destiny from start to finish. End of story. So we I don't know if it's unique, but we have our own warehouse. In fact, we've just added a 10,000 square foot addition to it. We're totally self-destined, in other words. We don't rely on any outside sources. We have our own sales team, our own project team, our own logistics team, our own warehouse team. Everything that we order for a given project is delivered to us here. It's checked for quality. It's checked that it's the right piece of equipment with the right loadings, etc. It's reboxed and it's put into a specific bay for that project. We know then that when we are ready to arrive on site with our own delivery vehicles and team, that everything is as it should be, no surprises, and we can offer a smooth installation throughout.
So, I mean, what does innovation play in your company? I mean, how do you bring innovation into HCE, and have you got any notable achievements or advancements that you're proud of?
Well, there's many things we've been proud of over the years. You know, as we've grown, you know, our portfolio has grown with us, and, you know, we're very proud of that. But without being too sales orientated, I think the best thing that we've offered of late, and this is definitely in the last couple of years or so, is that we now offer support packages where clients that require a turnkey package, which will involve civils work, building work, we actually walls, floors, ceilings, we do that in-house now. We don't rely on others for that either. So when a customer has a budget for the complete project, we can sit down and have the discussion, and we can put a proper program together using our own personnel and our own resources and do the job from start to finish. And I think that is not necessarily innovative, but it probably is in our industry. I know lots of others use subcontractors, which is reliant on when subcontractors can do things and when they can't do things. We're totally in control again. So this control thing, I think, is big in being able to deliver something on time. Let's not forget, these jobs get put back. You know, we're last in to most projects.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
It's the last thing that happens. If the builder's 4 weeks late, we're then told, actually, you haven't got 2 weeks now, you've got a week. Well, in some ways, we have to manage that. Of course we do, because you can't fit more than 24 hours into a day. But having everything at our fingertips, we are able to give it, you know, serious thoughts and, in the majority of cases, overcome these issues. So yeah, we're quite proud of that.
And, I mean, what's next for HCE Food Service Equipment? You know, I know you've just recently joined CEDA, I believe.
Well, we've rejoined, yeah.
We were
members years ago. Yeah, no, that was years ago. Yes, we've rejoined CEDA. We thought that it was important. I mean, CEDA's grown in the years that I've known it, because I remember when it started.
So just for people that don't know, sorry, CEDA is Catering Equipment Distributors Association, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, yeah. You know, it brings some good things to the party. The training offered is phenomenal, to whether that be sales or technical training, the bulletins that are issued. It gives everybody a chance to get together on occasion as well and share experiences. So the whole principle of CEDA now is far more advanced and far more useful than it used to be.
So what is next for HCE Food Service Equipment?
Watch this space, Radford. It's looking increasingly likely we'll be involved in a very high profile project with a client we worked with since 2014. An international name, in fact, that we all know well. But until we get the order in our hands, of course, I'm keeping stum.
Well, great. Thanks for that, Steve. We'll chat some more as we get back to the episode. We're now rejoined by John Benson-Smith as we carry on talking about kitchen design and technology in the food service sector. What do you think about kitchen design? I know you've been involved in quite a lot of kitchen design, some massive refurbishment at Man City. What considerations do you think about?
Well, I want to understand a lot more detail about the operation. So I want to understand the forecast P&L over the covers and the financial part of it. I want to understand the kind of the food architecture. I want to see typical examples of dishes and menus, and I want to understand the hand movements, the processes, logistics, ergonomics. It's the layouts, the flow. I want to understand the OPEX, the headcount, skill, the brands. It's that whole piece, which you can only, if you want to get it right, you've got to understand that. But having spent 200 years in kitchens, to me, it's quite easy. I'm able to get shoulder to shoulder with the occupants, if that's the right word, to kind of get into their heads and understand how they want stuff done. And then nicely suggest that maybe there's another way, or I can compliment. You know those words that you have to use nowadays because everyone gets upset about being challenged. But you want to try and add some value to whatever the project's going to be. So I'm very good at interpreting stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. And I think it's really key to kind of look at the whole holistic operation, the menu. Yeah. And I remember once, I won't say who or whatever, but a client came to me and said, oh, could you have a look at this kitchen design? Because somebody's done it for us. It wasn't in our sector. It wasn't, so let's just put that out there. It was someone outside of our sector had done this kitchen design, properly done in CAD and everything. And I looked at it and thought, well, that's great, but there's not a single oven on the side. Like, nothing. It was like, wait, how are you going to cook in this kitchen? But yeah, exactly. You've got to think about the menu and the operation. Steve, I mean, what hot trends are you seeing coming through in commercial kitchens in 2024?
That's a very interesting question, in all honesty. I think the truth of the matter is that things go round in circles. Most recently, we've been involved in a number of open plan kitchens, or at least kitchens which have a large hatch with a couple of heat shelves so that clients, customers can see the food being cooked, see the operation in the kitchen, pretty much like these television programs where you get the action in the kitchen and you get some interaction.
People want that. They want that theatre, don't they? They want that live. And they want to see what chefs are doing. I mean, especially with all these shows, everything, and MasterChef and et cetera. They want to see, get involved and be part of it.
Absolutely. So I think a number of restaurants are trying to emulate that. And we've certainly done a number of designs which have been very successful. And there's so many more add-ons too. You can have tasting evenings, you can have live cooking and actually involve people. And with theme nights, obviously you're bringing more people in, people talk to people, and before you know where you are, your business is thriving. So yeah, that's probably the first thing I'd say. The other area, which I think we're going to touch on maybe later, is technology. I think that's got a big part to play in the hot trends of kitchens. You know, the combi ovens and what have you are all using smartphones now to program and remote control things, get things started in advance. It's all getting very technological in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely. Some great points there, Steve. And I think, and just picking up on what you said, John, I mean, poor kitchen design, you know, how does it impact on productivity and workflow and then the business itself? What, you know?
Well, I have a word or a sentence. It's called fit for purpose, which normally a whole variety of people on a new concept cringe at when I say, is it fit for purpose? But you've got to remember, we normally remember the fact that the whole design stage and the fit out is probably going to be what? 1 year, 2 year maximum? Yeah? A lot of grumping and it's always late and overspent. But then let's never, ever, ever forget the occupants are going to spend the next 20 to 50 years in that space.
Yeah, yeah, true.
So this isn't just a case of scattering equipment and a mop sink, which we always put in for some reason. You've actually, there's a big responsibility, but to answer your question, if we get design and the kit right, it will help retention, morale, staff welfare, quality on the plate. It'll actively help the profits and loss, customer satisfaction. It's about all of those different things. You've also got this capital investment against the OPEX. So capital you do once, but OPEX is the cost you have every single day for the next 20 to 50 years. So if you've got to go down a corridor, up a lift, down the staircase...
Often overlooked in a design.
Gets completely ignored. And then they're left with this horrible way of serving, you know. But then, of course, I do understand the other side of it, where client doesn't have an opinion, doesn't really know, and all those kind of things. Does that make sense?
No, you're bang on the money there. And people just bang on about the CapEx, but the OPEX is actually more important, isn't it?
It is.
Because they could be... lumbered with this kitchen that costs an absolute fortune to operate.
Yeah, I know.
The truth of the matter is that sometimes kitchens can be too big, too small. And I think the balance of getting it right for the operation is so key. For example, we've been presented with architect's plans which show a kitchen which you'd never be able to cook in a million years. And on the reverse flip of the coin, you get a kitchen that's too big. And we've said, look, why don't you cut that off and use it for something else? Because you've got so much cross-trafficking between operations, preparation, cooking, serving, returning to dishwash. You've got to get that balance as best you can, absolutely right. And that's easier with a larger kitchen than it is a smaller one, of course. Mm. But all in all, I think that's a very, very key point.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And sustainability, you know, if we go back like 10 years or 2010, I don't know when we're talking about 10, 15 years ago, people were talking about sustainability, but I felt that it was much more of a talk than an action. And now I'm seeing, I speak to clients, that they're serious about sustainability because now, with the price of electricity particularly, there's a real advantage to trying to go carbon neutral and trying to become sustainable. I mean, I don't know what you've seen, John, out there about sustainability and what your clients are saying to you.
I think there's an argument between the brain and the heart. I think they all want that. But sometimes when it comes down to budgets and costs, I think sometimes they change, which can be, to me, if you've got principles and you've got beliefs and you've got values and an ethos, then stick to it or don't. I'm not very good at this kind of hovering and swapping and changing. But I think it's about, well, I suppose, what does sustainable mean? Sustainable can be existing in business, can't it? It can be the fact that, you know, we're going to offer employment and it's going to work for a long time. Or it can be, as you know, what you said. But, yeah, it's, you want a kitchen that if you're going to do it, you do it really well and it works and it makes a difference. What I don't get is this kind of disposable world. I see, you know, for example, within my work within Stadia, God forbid, when they get a new contract or they've done a massive fit out, and you'll see a juggernaut arrive with tons and tons and tons of broken, knackered old equipment on it. And I'm thinking, guys, we need to be able to design this, not from distributor, but from manufacturing, so we can unplug certain elements and add other things in. And some of the equipment is, dare I say it, controversially designed to only last 3 to 5 years. So we've got to change some attitudes there, I think, if you really want to make a difference.
True. Steve, what's your view on sustainability?
To be honest, Radford, it's not a lot different. I think the key issue here is that if you would deal with a large blue chip company or indeed a government ran type of establishment, invariably you get a pre questionnaire which goes pages and pages of sustainability, which is key and important for them and the people that can afford and employ people to write all these notes. This offers brownie points, of course it does. But I think with smaller independent businesses, with compliant equipment invariably, you know, becoming price restrictive, most, I would say, smaller independent probably would probably feel that sustainability is just energy efficiency. Great, it can help with utility bills, but in all honesty, I'm not entirely swayed that in many cases they're necessarily concerned about the carbon footprint. So I think really and truly, you know, if it's an owner business, the price of the equipment is important and buying the best they can, value for money-wise. That's how I feel about it. That's just a reality as far as I'm concerned.
No, you're right. It's difficult at times starting up a business and things. So it kind of leads me on. Look, I think it's really commendable that the market leader's introduced a new product. I'm sure you've both seen it. you know, they're selling over 1.2 million appliances they've got in the marketplace now. And as we saw last week, Rationale launched the iHexagon, which is combining combi oven and micro technology on every shelf. I mean, what's your view here? Have they solved a problem that didn't exist, or is this some amazing innovation? And I've got my own views. I'll share it in a bit. But yeah, Steve, what's your view on iHexagon?
Well, truth to tell, the technology itself isn't new. Going back a number of years, I recall that a leading brand manufacturer actually developed a unit, but it wasn't successful and it never really took off because it wasn't reliable. This instance, Rationale claim that it's the first on the market to actually combine all three. Now, there's a number of things that you can read into that. My view, giving thought to where it would work. We don't know what the pricing structure is yet, but the reality for me is that, you know, it's all about speed this day and age. You know, if you've got banqueting kitchens for hundreds of people, like was alluded to earlier, then if you can increase the cooking process by 30%, which is a claim that Rationale are making, but maintain the same quality that comes out of most combination ovens this day and age, then it's got to be good, worthwhile, isn't it? It's got to be successful, surely.
Yeah, I think if you're, and it probably leads into John's view, really, but I think if you're looking to, you know, knock out 40 burgers in 8 minutes or whatever it is, I think it's a great bit of kit. I'm, you know, if you're doing smaller numbers, I'm not sure, but we have to see how they're going to apply it.
Just as a PS to the Rationale oven in particular, being the first on the market to deliver a quality product at a faster pace, what one has to consider is the cavity size. Up to now, accelerated cooking is pretty much restricted to microwave size cooking appliances.
One shelf,
maybe four shelves if you're lucky. Introducing microwave into a larger cavity with 6, 10, maybe 20 grids and having that increased speed, I would suggest that banquet style operations would probably succeed very well with a product with that speed and that quality.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I know they're being selective as to who can purchase, and rightly, because I said, don't want people taking it on the market and it just falling over. And I think they've only released it in three markets, which I know is Germany, UK, and one other. I'm not sure whether one other is. John, what's your view on this iHexagon, which is obviously big news in the sector?
I don't really have an opinion, to be honest. I'm a bit of a misery, Radford. I just walk into kitchens and commonly see a thermocouple and think, oh my God. You know, what I'm saying is, you know, the Rationale, when I walk into a kitchen and I see a Rationale, that normally says to me, it's like a Thermomix. And by the way, I had one of the first ones in 1986 before you were born, Radford. But when I see a Rationale, it normally says someone's committed or nearly committed to great food. You know, but I tend to look at, I'm not impressed by modern technology. I just see the fact that generally there's a lot of kitchen fit outs in the UK that are, you know, without being a misery, can be quite cheap and nasty and horrible. And you're thinking, oh my God, guys, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas you go to France, it's a different animal. You go to the Middle East, wow, you know. And I think that all delivers better food, but please, the thermocoupler. Please, can we somebody come out in this modern day world and rid us of that damn thing where chefs have got bits of kitchen paper and tin foil to try and make them work?
True. And I think, well, we'll watch this space. I mean, look, I love Rationale. I think it's great. And but we'll see how they go. I'm sure it's going to be successful.
Hmm. But one thing I would say, though, is 67% of chefs are dyslexic. Right, and you end up going to an oven and saying to one of the chefs, do me a favor, how the bloody hell does this damn thing turn on? How can I? The things are overcomplicated.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I put more time and effort into the welding and the casters and the door and those bits, which if you're not careful, will be hanging off after a couple of years. Not with Rationale. So I think it's, imagine if Tonka, do you remember Tonka?
Yep.
Tonka toys. Remember, if Tonka made an oven, you know, if Tonka made an oven, that's what you kind of want, you know. But yeah, there's some great stuff, but some of it is just goes over my head.
Steve, I mean, where do you see technology now in kitchens and, you know, AI, smart kitchens, all this sort of stuff? Where are you seeing that, Steve?
I'm inclined to agree with John to some degree. You know, I mean, technology is a wonderful thing, but, you know, I'm no youngster.
We don't want to come across as grumpy old men.
No, we don't. But listen.
What's wrong with that?
In my early days... Well, no, true. But in my early days, you'd sell a—I don't know if you remember the old Blodgett D1000
yes.
convection ovens
with the door that used to whack the person yes. who walked past.
Yeah, and probably pulled out about 20 kilowatts of power every hour.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yes.
And also, we mentioned the Savoy earlier. We had to rip out a. Oh, must have been 20-foot long hot cupboard, which was made by a company called Benham
oh, yes.
Oldham. Mm-hmm. That's going back in the day. I mean, that thing, honestly, that steel was a quarter of an inch thick.
Whoa.
And it took six men to carry one sheet. You know, there's not enough of that. I think the Blodgett still make their ovens. In fact, I know they make their ovens, but combi oven having overtaken, you know, it's technology seems to be a bit over the top in my view. And I agree. At the end of the day, you want to cook. And there's only so much you can do in the cooking arena. You can produce good food on a solid top range in the fryer, quite frankly. So
yeah, true. I think, can you share some sort of experiences where you've had to really tailor, like the kitchen design, been something maybe obscure to a chef's requirement, Stephen?
Well, I don't know about obscure. I know one instance that would probably come to mind is we did a job for a large hotel and residence in London some years ago. And it was one of the first hotels that was built from scratch for about 40 years back in 2012. And to develop the hotel, they had to bury down five levels. They had a spa and pool on one level. And on the third level below was a catering facility. And to get everything down, there was a big borehole in the middle and all the equipment was brought down in shafts, delivered to the kitchen area and installed. Great. All installed, all commissioned, looking a treat, photographs taken, staff trained. They employed the chef. The chef came and said, I'm not using that.
Oh.
I said, okay. It was modular equipment, which was bolted together to form one continuous run. He wanted a bespoke cooking suite from scratch. Maltini, in fact, which is quite a sturdy, heavy-duty range of equipment.
Was this a well-known chef, I guess?
It was a Michelin star chef, very well-known, but I don't think now is the platform to
share that.
Put it this way, everybody would know. And so we had to have manufactured in a very short space of time in a European country a bespoke cooking suite, which was all welded together on site, which came looking like a patchwork quilt, but by the end of the installation, you wouldn't have known it was a one-piece top. So that was a chef, you know, where although he had griddles, boiling tops, solid tops, fryers, rise and fall grills, everything was there. No, it had to be in a bespoke suite, but the same thing mirrored. So that's one experience.
It's quite an experience as well, isn't it? I mean, a bit of a nightmare, yeah. Really, once you've designed a kitchen, then... I mean, I've had it as well. You know, I've been designing a project and I think I've been through two or three executive chefs during the design period because John said it can go on for a year or so. And then every time they've got an opinion and they want to change it and, you know... But anyway, you get in the end, don't you? I mean, John, what kind of... I think I know what you're going to tell me, but... if someone's renovating their kitchen, what's the best bit of advice you can give them if they're going to go ahead with a big project in London or Manchester or wherever in the UK?
Well, I think it's the points that I mentioned previously, which was about, you know, gaining the information. But if you're going to keep equipment or you're going to what does the word renovate mean? But the first thing I'd do would be to get an audit done on the present age of the equipment and how long it lasts for and all that stuff. That doesn't happen, which I think is really important. Second thing is, you know, I'd ask them 50 questions, but I would say, do it properly. Don't bodge it. Do it fit for purpose. Get the design exactly right because it's the engine room. That's what I would say. And probably... Don't be frivolous. And if I was an investor, going regards what you guys just said, I'd want to see sheer total evidence regards the workflows of the people designing this, not so much you specialists, but the physical chefs, to know that the business wasn't going to waste a shed load of money, because I've seen so much money commonly wasted regards bizarre designs and bizarre layouts and bizarre equipment that actually they never ever use.
Yeah, true. I can't really add anything to that. It's crazy that people embark on kitchen projects sometimes with such a small budget, or even sometimes too big a budget. But it's the engine room, isn't it, of the kitchen, of the whole property, of the restaurant, the hotel, whatever it is.
John, what's
your view on things like robotics and AI and stuff like that in the kitchen?
Robotics, yes, it's coming, and it's gonna jump on us. And the smart, clever manufacturers are already on with it. I think, if anything, the distributors are the ones that are a bit more kind of, well, I don't really think this is going to work. But typically, you look at the UK, and it depends which figures you listen to or believe, or which newspaper you read. But you've got some publications telling us there's 25,000 vacancies for chefs. You got another one that says you got 200,000 vacancies for chefs. Feels to me, however you dress it up, that this issue with the modern generation, the younger generation, probably aren't as, they don't embrace working in hot, sweaty, tough environments as much as the grumpies did or do. So I can see robotics coming in. And I think that's going to come thick and fast. And if you look at anything within life, you look at, you know, mobile telephones or whatever, or, you know, we don't walk around with a red phone box still, do we? The world's moved on, and it's going to come. And it's interesting that some of the robotics companies, they are looking at this in a very, very different way to the traditional manufacturers.
Yeah. I mean, and I'll probably plug it anyway. There's a restaurant embankment, you know, by Festival Hall. Called Ping Pong, and they've got two robots in there, front of house, and they bring a lot of, well, one of them brings the food out and one of them takes all the dirties away.
And
it's quite remarkable to see. I took my little boy down to watch it, and we loved it, just watching them in and out, you know. So one was clean, one was dirty, but quite good. Steve, what do you feel about this whole robotics or AI? I mean, are you using AI in your business at the minute?
Not really. It's a bit price prohibitive at the moment,
right?
If I'm honest, I could relate to the convenience of this, but in terms of reality, I don't think you'll ever. We alluded earlier to the theatre of cooking. The result that's on the plate, so much is done by the human hand that I think that, as far as robotics are concerned, it's not the same product every time. And that's what makes food interesting, in my view. So I can't see how it's going to take off, quite frankly.
Yeah, I suppose, but maybe you're talking about more the high end, but in the more chain business where they're knocking out the same burger or whatever, maybe that's, you know, the quick serve, maybe there's more scope for it.
Yeah, I know that. And we've produced fast food outlets, and the importance is that you get consistency. McDonald's are consistent throughout the whole of the world. You know, a burger in Spain is the same as a burger in London. But that's one particular area. It is an area where a lot of people are going for convenience. We know that. It's been that for a while. But in my view, if you're talking of restaurants, hotels, you know, it's an area that we really must fundamentally keep going.
Yeah. I mean, I went to a presentation on AI, this bit of technology, probably really interesting for you, John. I don't know if you've seen it, where there's this one bit of technology they bought out, and it's working. It's currently being used in, I think it's one of the Birmingham football clubs, where you go in, you know, when you go at a stadium or an event or a O2 or whatever it is, and you pick up your drinks and you're queuing to pay. Basically, as you go around picking up your drinks, as you walk in, it spots you, it identifies your collar to you, and it can identify about 2,000 people at once. And as you walk around picking up your drinks, your snacks, whatever it is, by the time you get to the till, it knows you're at the till and it's populated your tray and you just pay. And I tried to sort of play a game by put a Guinness back and put a Heineken on, and still, by the time I got to the till, it had it exactly right.
You're totally correct. It's that Amazon mentality. It's the American. It's very, very clever. But all I would say, because I'm a Yorkshireman now and a bit of a misery, is it the best burger? Is it a great drink? Or is the drink warm and the burger's sloppy and a bit horrible? And do you know what I mean? Let's not forget.
Yeah.
I think, you know, what we said just now about, you were talking about your Josper and the fryer next to it. Good old back to basics of get the basics done right.
So, well, that concludes this episode of Kitchen Curiosity. On the next episode, we have a CEO of a restaurant group who's a commercial finance lawyer, now turned restaurateur. He's so commercially savvy, he makes the Bank of England governor look like a novice. And we're joined by his business partner, who's completely dedicated to his craft, one of the finest chefs Liverpool has ever produced. And we're joined by their sponsor, who runs a business that turns pre-loved kitchen equipment market on its head. These gentlemen will give you a valuable insight how to keep customers coming back to your restaurant, a secret to food service budgeting, and how to ensure your long-term business model is sustainable, and so much more. As will be tradition in this series, the guest of each episode will be posing the first question to the next guest. So, John, what is the question to the next, well, in this case, two guests?
Okay. You've got the environmental health officer, the financial director, and you've got the Michelin guide. All three come to see you at the same time. Which do you see first, and why, and in what order? Michelin inspector, environmental health officer, and the financial director.
Well, thanks, John. I'm sure they're going to love you for that. I'd like to take this opportunity to say a big thank you to our listeners, and I hope you've enjoyed our first episode. And also thank you so much to John Benson-Smith and Steve Holly for joining me on today's podcast. Click subscribe, follow, and don't miss the next episode on the 15th of April. I've been your host, Radford Chancellor, and you've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity.